This is Lecture 26. We're going to talk about imposition of constraints today. Just as a self-evident reminder, however, we've been concentrating on basically one, occasionally 2 degrees of freedom. We want to generalize to J degrees of freedom, where J is a finite number. Little j then will run that label the degrees of freedom. So our path integral will be represented in the following way: P sub j, Q super j dot, we'll put our coordinate levels upstairs and our momentum downstairs generally, minus Hamiltonian, little h, big H, I don't care, P of, and Q, we'll let the symbol P and Q stand for all of the variables, 2j variables, dt, dp, and dq, more rightly should be understood as product over the separate momenta and the coordinates, but we'll do all of those as if they were one, a single curly script M. And with that formula, we have basically generalized from 1 degree of freedom to capital J degrees of freedom. Now we want to introduce the concept of constraints. And so we have started section 6.5, imposition of constraints. In a loose manner of speaking, if I took this three-dimensional figure to represent three axes in a higher-dimensional phase space. Phase space is an even-dimensional object, so should be four or more here. I can't represent all four, but just imagine this. And I have some kind of surface in here on which I want to constrain my object. Yes, sir. Question.
What will happen if you said j go to infinity?
What happens when j goes to infinity? That becomes a field theory question. When you have infinite degrees of freedom, that's equivalent to a field theory. We will try to talk about that in our next chapter, chapter 7. infinitely many degrees of freedom. Right now, I want to talk about finitely many degrees of freedom. This will be a surface. I'll call it script C. It's the hypersurface of the constraints, constraint hypersurface where the constraints are fulfilled. The constraints are labeled by Greek letters. Phi 1 of the phase space variables equal to 0. Phi capital A, PQ equal to 0. So there will be capital A of these, and we'll use Greek letters for running between 1 and capital A. There is no equation of motion here. There's no time derivative in this. So this is a statement that you live on a sub-manifold or sub-set of the original phase space. How do we impose that on our dynamics? We impose that by means of Lagrange multipliers. And let me give you the elementary idea of how that works by the following example. We'll work in two dimensions. We have an xy plane. I have a function f of xy, which I wish to extremize. So that means I want to have variations of f of x, comma y equal to 0. I will plot my f this way. This is f values, f equals 1, f equals 2, f equals 3, let us say. And I want to do this subject to a constraint, phi of x, comma y equals to 0. And I will use my colored chart here, which seems to be blue today, to illustrate the surface phi equal to zero. Now, a variation of the x and y such that delta f equals zero is clearly one in which you move along in the direction where f is constant. F is constant would mean that you have made a variation such that f is still has the same numerical value, therefore you haven't changed the value of f. If instead I move perpendicular to f, then I would get a variation which was not zero. I want to find the variation of that f consonant with the fact that I am allowing my function to be zero. Suppose I pick this point up here on the where the blue and white lines cross in a significant way. If I stay with phi equal to zero, I'm in this direction. But if I want my variation, I'm in that direction. So what I have instead is this point where these two curves are kissing each other. That's the best way I want to talk about it. More to the point, the perpendicular to the two curves are parallel to each other. That means that gradient f in a two-dimensional sense and gradient phi are parallel vectors. And I say that by putting in a numerical coefficient lambda, which is the factor of proportionality to those.
Doesn't
lambda is the Lagrange multiplier. Question?
Yes. Doesn't that imply that your phase-space manifold is orientable? It's an orientable manifold, right?
Question is, does that make phase-space manifold orientable? And I'll be happy to say yes, I don't care. We get a nodding of the head the other way in the audience.
This is a local
question. This is a local question. I don't see what it's got to do with the global topology. Okay, so that's the pictorial representation of how a Lagrange multiplier can be used. Of course, you want to solve this equation right here, subject, of course, to the condition that the constraint is identically zero. And that would pick out this particular point that we have illustrated on our figure. Okay, so we're going to start by reviewing for you classical theory of constraints. In the Hamiltonian language. So we start with our original Hamiltonian, and we're going to add to it some Lagrange multipliers, lambda A, alpha rather, phi, alpha, P, and Q. We put those two together, well, okay, minus sign here, put that all together in our action functional. To identify our new classical action. Now, of course, we haven't changed the numerical value of our old one because on the physical space of interest, all the phis will vanish. Here, the lambda alpha are, at the very least, functions of time, but they can also be functions of the phase space variables. And occasionally, that will turn out to be the case. We'll talk about that in a moment, but this is not normally stressed. If I vary the action functional here, and I want that to be zero, then for example, I vary the p's, I get q dot j minus dh dp minus lambda alpha d phi alpha dp, this will be p j, against variation of pj dt. And there will be similar terms when I vary the q's, I get a integration by parts term, which we will drop because we know the variations should vanish at the end point. And I have minus PJ dot minus derivative of the QJs minus lambda alpha d phi alpha dQJs, variation of QJs, integral dt, plus the third term, which comes up with a minus sign actually, lambda alpha phi alpha pq, variation of the lambda alpha of t dt. So we have these three contributions. One of them will give me the equation for the QJs. QJ dot will then be equal to dH dPJ plus lambda alpha d phi alpha dPJ. The second Hamilton equation minus PJ dot is dH minus dH dQJ minus lambda alpha d phi alpha dQJ. And the third equation we get by setting the variation of the lambdas has to be zero, so that forces our phi alpha pq to be zero are constraint functions.
The first equation, the last sign is a plus, isn't it? Sorry, the first sign in the last equation, in that column.
So there's a correction being suggested
P dot.
From the audience here?
Yeah, P dot.
P dot?
Should it be plus?
Well, when I vary the q, I have to integrate by parts.
Oh, you already did integrate by parts.
Yes, I'm integrating by parts to get the p dot.
Okay.
And that surface term I've already neglected.
Yeah, you're right.
Okay. Now, what would happen if the lambdas were functions of the pqs as well? I would get contributions of the type d lambda alpha dp J times phi alpha. Things like that would come in. But the phi alphas are constrained to be zero. So that would end up making no contribution to the situation. So this is not an essential modification of things. Okay, those are our classical equations. It's convenient to write them in Poisson brackets. So A comma B, I will define to be dA dQ super J dB dP sub J minus dA dP sub J dB dQ super J, summed on J. And it is straightforward to see that Q dot J then is the Poisson bracket of QJ itself with the Hamiltonian. This picks out only the first part, only the Qs will contribute, so I get a DHDP plus a lambda alpha outside and a phi, a QJ Poisson bracket with the constraint function, phi alpha. P dot J is likewise given by PJ commute with Hamiltonian. The sign that is so important in the Hamilton equations comes because now only the second term in this Poisson bracket will be important. Plus lambda alpha PJ phi alpha. So this is an alternative way to write the three equations of motion. Now, the general function W, P, and Q, time derivative, dot again, would be given by the same kind of argument, W Poisson bracket with H plus lambda alpha W phi alpha itself. If there was an explicit dependence on time, then I would have to add a partial with respect to T. But I'm not worrying about that special case. An essential question to ask yourself is about the constraints themselves. I would like the constraints to be zero for all time. So that means their time derivative must vanish. But the time derivative is given by this very equation, phi alpha h. Now I'm going to change my summation index here to beta. So I have a phi alpha in front, phi beta in the second part of my relation. And the vanishing of this is a very essential part of the story. That breaks into basically two main divisions with a nuisance third division. Division one. Okay, let's give it a name. First class constraints. Suppose phi alpha phi beta Poisson bracket equals zero on C. C is where all of these guys vanish. All of these guys vanishing equals or defines for you the subset of the phase space called C. One way to do that is to have the phi alphas, phi betas, linearly dependent on the phis themselves, say phi gamma, with coefficients, let's call it C alpha beta gamma. What about the C's? The C's could be numbers, or the C's could be functions of the phase space variables themselves. And we'll talk about both cases in a minute. So this is a situation where it would vanish equal zero on C, because these things are already there, equal to zero. What about the Hamiltonian situation? Phi alpha commute with Hamiltonian. That could also be zero on C, for example. It too could be a linear combination of the constraint functions. That would then vanish on C. If that's the case, if true, if these things are true, then this is zero already. This is zero already. And it puts no restriction on the Lagrange multipliers. No restriction on lambdas. Okay, that's great, except I cannot solve the equations of motion. I cannot solve this equation of motion unless I know what lambda is. So that means I must make a choice of lambdas. It's called a gauge choice. Must choose lambda to finalize solution. And we will give several examples of all this very soon, shortly. Okay, that's called first class constraints. The characteristic feature is the lambdas are not determined by the equations of motion. Nevertheless, you must choose them to finalize your solution. That's called a gauge choice, or a choice of gauge. And many problems of interest in physics are indeed of the first class kind. Yang-Mills theories, electromagnetism, example of that. General relativity is of that type. The Yang-Mills theories have constant C's. Gravity has non-constant C's. So they get a distinction. if C, alpha, beta, gamma are numbers, and that's called a closed first class system, and you recognize perhaps this functional form here as the appropriate form for a Lie algebra. If the C, alpha, beta, gammas are functions of phase space, and of course I mean non-trivial function, non-constant functions of phase space, then that's called an open first class system, and that's the case for general relativity. Okay, let's talk about situation number two. I'm going to draw a stark contrast here between one and two, as if everything was either one way or the other, and then we'll talk about the fact that you can have intermediate situations as well. This is called second-class constraints. Phi alpha plus on bracket phi beta is not zero on C. Let's even assume that this, we'll call it delta, is nowhere degenerate. So that's a matrix I could invert. Now that's an extreme case, but let me just talk about it for a moment. So that is a non-degenerate situation. Okay, well, what happens then? I still want this to be zero. Therefore, I have the equation lambda beta times delta alpha beta plus phi alpha comma h must equal zero. So I solved that equation for the lambdas, which says lambda beta is minus delta alpha beta inverse times phi alpha comma Poisson bracket with h. So the lambdas are fixed now by the equations of motion. They're not freely specifiable. You don't have a choice. The choice is made for you in order to stay on the constraint hypersurface. This is the extreme case of a second class system of constraints. In point of fact, they are fictitious forces, if you like, which come along and force you to stay on the constraint hypersurface. Over here, in the first class situation, such forces were not necessary. The natural dynamical evolution of these things just kept you in that space by itself. Okay, now, so then I put down the caveat, we could have a mixed combination of first and second class constraints. In that case, this delta would have a certain rank to it, and that only that sub matrix then would have an inverse, and on those it would be second class, on the rest of it would be first class. So this could be mixed combination of first and second class constraint. Not conceptually more difficult than what we have already. Now here's the nuisance category. We'll call it 3, but we'll put parentheses around it. What have we done? We have done this following situation. We have two terms here to deal with, this one and this one. One involving Poisson bracket of phi alpha with h, the second one phi alpha with phi beta. We've taken the first case was both of those will vanish automatically on the hypersurface. The second case we looked at, this one did not vanish automatically on the hypersurface. Of course, if this term was already zero on the hypersurface, then the lambdas would be equal to zero. That's fine, they are still specified. Now the third possibility of this kind is that this part is zero on the hypersurface, but this part is not zero on the hypersurface. So this is a situation where we have phi alpha phi beta equals zero on C, but phi alpha comma H is not zero on C. The lambdas can't do anything for you, because the lambdas appear times coefficients which actually vanish. So lambdas cannot help. So what happens if you want to continue playing the game? You must have to introduce this as a new constraint, a new function which you must automatically set equal to zero. You must add it to your original family of constraints. And then you have to test for consistency again. For example, what about phi dot nu? That should be zero, but is it? Maybe that will require even further constraints. So you continue that process until you're done, until you're not adding any new constraints, and you return to either one or two as above. Either you have first class constraints, second class constraints, or more probably, more likely, some mixed category of the two.
So you've got finitely many degrees of freedom. If you run out, you've just got nothing.
The question is finitely many degrees of freedom. If I run out, if I put too many constraints on, then I will just run out of phase space. I go down to a point or something. Points are actually useful examples to talk about, and we will talk about point examples. We're going to now turn our attention to some examples that illustrate all of this for us. Question.
Are these point three, is that called third class or
no,
second class?
No, it doesn't have a name. Just
they're called secondary constraints.
What?
They're called secondary constraints.
Well, they have a name, primary and secondary. Primary is what you started with, you thought was enough. This is a secondary constraint. It arose by taking the time derivative of your original set of first constraints. But it's just presumably, another way to look at it is you were not smart enough to think of all the constraints in the first place. Crumbs. Okay. Some examples. And I think the examples will help you understand this. Example one, I'm always starting with the classical action, PQ dot, so we only have one P and one Q, minus P squared over 2, that makes it a free particle, minus lambda times P minus 1 dt. So I vary the Q, I get P dot equals zero. Momentum is conserved. I vary the Q and I get, I beg your pardon, I just done that. I vary the P and I get Q dot equals P plus lambda. I vary the lambda and I get P equals one. Okay. P equals one is consistent with P dot equals zero. Put that p equal 1 into this equation, I have q dot equals 1 plus lambda of t. So q, I integrate that, is t plus integral lambda of s ds of t plus some constant, q sub 0. Well, that is my solution, p equal 1. I can't go any further, I can't tell you exactly what q is until I have explicitly said what the lambda is. So this is a first class situation because I have no fixing of the lambda by the equation of motion. I can give you this integral because it's so simple to do, but I can't give you the answer to make the computer happy until I tell you what the limit is.
Okay, example two.
I equal PQ dot, and it's lambda P minus mu Q. Now, I have two Lagrange multipliers, lambda 1 and lambda 2. I've just called it lambda and mu, just to get you used to the fact that we can have other Greek letters. So I vary the P, and I get Q dot equals lambda. Vary the Q, I get P dot equals minus mu. I vary the lambda, P equals 0. Vary the mu, I get Q equals 0. P equals 0, Q equals 0. That's consistent with the time derivatives, but only if they are 0. So that forces lambda equal to mu equal to 0. The Lagrange multipliers are fixed. And if I took the Poisson bracket of my two constraint functions, I would find I'm exactly in this situation. My two constraint functions, Q alpha, Q phi alpha, phi beta, that Poisson bracket is unity, which certainly does not vanish on any submanifold, because one is one. So that's exactly a second class situation, second class constraints. Number three, I PQ dot minus P squared over 2 minus lambda Q dt. Vary the P, I get Q dot equals P. Vary the Q, I get P dot equals minus lambda. And then I get Q equal to 0. Okay. Q equal to 0 forces P to be 0. Right here. Otherwise, P could be anything it liked because we had a Lagrange multiplier. So this is actually a new constraint. That's not a dynamical equation. It's not saying time derivative equals anything. It's a dynamic. It's a constraint equation. So here is the case three, where we got from our equation of motion some new constraint which didn't vanish until because it was a Poisson bracket with the Hamiltonian. So we're in this situation down here, number three. So we have to begin again. Secondary constraint is the good word. We found we needed another constraint function. Lambda Q minus mu P dt. And then we're not quite back to where we started from, but let's do it. We have a free particle here to deal with. What do we get? Q dot, vary the P, we get Q dot equals P. Vary the P plus mu. P dot equals minus lambda. P and Q are both 0. So P and Q both being 0, this is 0. This is 0 that forces the lambda to be 0. That's 0 that forces the mu to be 0. So lambda and mu are 0. We've ended up in the second class example question mark.
If you didn't start with any constraints, if the lambda Q was not at all there.
So your question is, if I started with no constraint?
Yeah, if you start with no constraint.
Yes.
Then you should be able to put those two constraints back, lambda Q and mu P, from secondary constraints.
Well, only if I if I didn't have the lambda q, there would be no ever, I never would have learned that q should have been zero. I need that here to force this first constraint, the primary constraint. Okay, we have a fourth example.
So it's always true that you need at least one primary constraint to get secondary constraints?
Well, right, it came from this equation, phi di equal phi h plus lambda phi phi. I needed something. If I have only one constraint, yes, fine, that Poisson bracket will vanish, but that constraint may not vanish with the Hamiltonian. That will give me the secondary constraint. Yes, I need one constraint to start with. Okay, fourth problem. This will be a useful exercise for us later when we go to quantum mechanics. Again, 1p and 1q. So this is my classical action. No Hamiltonian, vanishing Hamiltonian. One constraint function, which is called p squared over 2 plus q to the power 4 over 4 minus e, where e is a number to be specified. Vary the p, I get q dot equals lambda p. Vary the q, I get p dot equals minus lambda q cubed. Vary the lambda, and I get p squared over 2 plus q to the 4th over 4 equals e. All right, the lambda appears associated with the time derivative terms. So that's really dq divided by lambda of t times dt is equal to p. And that's also dp dt with a lambda in front of it equal to minus q cubed. Let's introduce a new time variable. Tau is going to be lambda of t dt, or tau is equal to integral of lambda of s ds up to some time t. So that means I have dq by d tau is equal to p, dp by d tau is equal to minus q cubed. Multiply this first equation by p over 2, dq d tau q over, by q cubed, so that's equal to p, that p times q cubed. I now take the dp d tau term and multiply it by p, which is then minus p q cubed from this equation. I now add these two equations, and I learn that q cubed dq by d tau plus p dp by d tau equals zero. I can integrate that equation. That's q to the power 4 divided by 4. P squared over 2 equals a constant, which my constraint says I must make E. So I have one free function in this solution. The lambda was unspecified, and I can use it to reparameterize the time. So this is a first-class system. And the lambda plays the role of d tau by dt. the functional dependence of the change in time.
Okay, now, any questions about classical constraints? Because we're going to switch into quantum theory in a minute, unless we have a few questions. Any questions? You want another example or two? No? I don't have it on the top of my head. I'll give you one more example.
But in this example, you started without any Hamiltonian.
Which one? This was an example with Hamiltonian zero, branching Hamiltonian.
So is it possible to fix a value of lambda and then...
Don't do that. I'm talking with your mother.
Okay, so if you fix a value of lambda and then you call, say lambda equals 1, because here lambda was a gate choice, so fix lambda to be 1, and can you say p squared by 2 plus q power 4 by 4 is Hamiltonian?
So he raises a very interesting question. Since lambda is free, can I use this lambda equal to 1 and call what's left there the Hamiltonian? And of course the answer is yes. This is a bit like a reparametrization invariant form of the problem you just spoke about. I've removed the Hamiltonian in favor of a constraint, and the new Hamiltonian is actually zero. That's rather like what happens in general relativity. There's no true Hamiltonian. Everything is coming in by the constraints.
Yes. Would like another example?
Would you like another example?
Right. Yeah, I would.
All right.
SO and SO3.
Okay. SO3, rotation group in three dimensions. So let us think of generators L1, which is like y d by dz minus z d by dy. These are generators of the rotation group. We'll call it Li, Lj, commute to give me Lk, the coefficient epsilon ijk. So this is the fully anti-symmetric symbol, epsilon 1, 2, 3, equal to unity. So these are three generators. And I choose my action to be, now I'm in three dimensions, so I'll need a p vector dot q vector dot. That's another way to write these multiple variables. I'll take a circularly symmetric situation. Let's call it p squared over 2 plus charge over magnitude q. That makes it look like a Coulomb problem. Put a minus sign to make it look like a real Coulomb problem. Something like that. Anyway, it's spherically symmetric. That's the important point. Plus my constraints here, lambda alpha times L alpha dt. So I have three Lagrange multipliers. I'm enforcing the constraints L1, L2, L3, all equal to zero. I have a rotationally symmetric Hamiltonian. So I look at Lj, well, I won't write my equations of motion for the p's and q's down. You can figure that out yourself. I'll just write that the constraint functions tell me that the three lambdas should be zero, three l's should be zero. Okay, what about l dot? That's Poisson bracket l alpha with Hamiltonian plus lambda beta l alpha lambda beta. Lambda alpha asks, what is the rotation properties of this Hamiltonian? How does this Hamiltonian transform under a rotation? But it is absolutely invariant under a rotation. So this part is identically zero. This part, according to this Poisson bracket connection, actually it should have been Poisson brackets, tells me that this is proportional to the L alpha, so that is also zero on the constraint hypersurface, and therefore my lambdas are all free to choose. Lambdas are free to choose, meaning I'm in a first class situation. First class constraints. And I'm looking at the solutions to this equation which have spherical symmetry. That's the only situation I'm imagining.
But the L's that you wrote there are operators that still work on something. What do they work on?
That's PZ.
Sorry?
YPZ minus ZPY is the.
Right, okay, should have been right. PZ minus ZPY in canonical variables. You're absolutely right. Thank you very much. Okay, we'll return to this problem actually when we come to our quantum theory and see how that has can be of interest to us.
You could also put only one or two of the L's into your constraints and learn something.
So the statement was I could put not all three L's, but I could put one or two. I could put one in, LZ, for example, rotation around the Z-axis, and then I could have more general Hamiltonians, which would be invariant under that.
Axially symmetric.
Axially symmetric. But I think if I put in two L's, wouldn't it be true I could... I would get L1 and the other L, and then I would be forced to create the third L, and so
to create one.
I'd have to create, add my new, add the third completion of that situation. Okay, the next thing we're going to talk about is quantum mechanics, and why don't we save a few minutes and start that next time.